Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Welcome, everyone. Today we're jumping into a book that, well, it didn't just hit the bestseller lists hard, it really shifted things in the world of suspense fiction. We're talking about Paula Hawkins's 2015 smash hit, The Girl on the Train.
It's such a powerhouse of a novel, and part of what makes it interesting, I think, is Hawkins herself. She'd spent, what, 15 years as a journalist, really honing those observational skills.
Right, and then she completely pivoted. She'd actually been writing romantic comedies before this under a different name, Amy Silver.
Yeah, it's quite the jump.
It really is. And yeah. You feel that journalistic precision in the writing, don't you? That sharp eye for detail. But here it's turned inwards, towards the dark secrets, often hidden in plain sight in suburban life.
Definitely. When it came out, the comparisons to Gone Girl were immediate and huge. It really helped solidify what people started calling domestic noir.
Exactly. That idea that the real danger, the real horror, might actually be inside the house with you, not some external monster.
And look, if we're going to navigate this story, you, the listener, need to know right away, the narrative compass Hawkins gives us is fundamentally unreliable. That's the core device.
She deliberately uses narrators who are deeply flawed, grappling with their own issues.
Which forces you to become the detective, essentially. You have to sift through their perspectives, their biases, their broken memories sometimes to figure out what's real. It's deliberately uncomfortable.
So let's start with the main source of that narrative fog, the title character herself, Rachel Watson, the girl on the train.
Okay, Rachel. When we first meet her, she's in a really bad place. Her marriage has collapsed, partly due to infertility struggles and then her spiraling alcoholism. She's lost her job. She's lost her home.
She's actually crashing on a friend's sofa, isn't she? And sort of pretending to still have her life together.
Pretty much. The only structure she has left is this daily commute into London she pretends to still make. The train journey itself.
And on that journey, she develops this.
Yeah.
This habit. This voyeuristic ritual.
Right. Staring out the window, specifically at one house, she becomes obsessed with the couple she sees there, nicknaming them Jess and Jason. In her mind, they have this perfect, idyllic life.
The life she feels she threw away, essentially. She projects all her lost hopes onto them.
And the painful irony, of course, is that their house is just a few doors down from the house she used to live in with her ex-husband, Tom.
Who now lives there with his new wife, Anna, and their baby. So every day she's literally riding past the wreckage of her own life.
It's a kind of self-punishment, isn't it? Mixed with this desperate fantasy about strangers.
Until one morning that fantasy just cracks.
Yeah.
From the train, she sees Jess, who is actually Megan Hipwell, on the balcony, kissing another man. Not Jason. Scott Hipwell.
And this glimpse of imperfection, this betrayal, it completely throws Rachel. It confirms maybe that the perfection she was imagining wasn't real anyway.
And then just days later, Megan Hipwell is reported missing.
This is the catalyst. Rachel goes from being this passive, heartbroken observer to someone who might actually know something. Because the night Megan disappeared, Rachel was in the area.
She'd gone out, gotten blackout drunk, maybe intending to confront Tom, maybe just drawn back to the old neighborhood. She wakes up the next morning with a cut on her head, covered in dirt.
And only these terrifying, fragmented flashes of memory, violent flashes. She knows she was near the underpass where Megan was last seen, but she can't recall what happened.
And that sets up the central question, the hook for the reader. Can you trust a witness who can't even trust herself? Her memories are shattered by alcohol, by grief, by trauma. Is she a key witness, a suspect, a victim? She honestly doesn't know.
It's a brilliant setup for suspense.
Now, adding to that complexity, it's not just Rachel telling the story, is it? Hawkins uses three first-person narrators. We get Rachel, Megan herself through flashbacks, and Anna, Tom's new wife.
Exactly. That's crucial. It's not just about one unreliable narrator. It's about navigating three different, very subjective viewpoints. You're constantly comparing their stories, looking for overlaps, for contradictions.
It really underscores that theme of deceptive appearances, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What Rachel sees from the train, or what Anna presents to the world, or even what Megan tried to hide, it's never the whole story.
Never. There's always something hidden beneath the surface.
Let's track Rachel's journey first. She starts off seeming quite passive, almost pathetic in her grief and addiction. But the mystery around Megan, this feeling she saw something important, it pushes her into action. Clumsy action, often disastrous action.
Yeah, she messes up a lot. But her arc is about clawing her way back, isn't it? Trying to reclaim not just the truth about Megan, but her own memory, her own identity, which she starts to suspect has been tampered with.
Right. Then you have Megan, Through her sections, which are set before she disappears, we see she wasn't this perfect Jess at all. She was deeply restless, unhappy.
And carrying this immense secret, this past trauma. As a teenager, she accidentally caused the death of her baby brother. Not her own child, as stated in the outline, but her infant sibling. This tragedy has haunted her, fueling her affairs, her lies. She's constantly trying to escape her own past.
The tragic figure, really. And then there's Anna, Tom's new wife. Initially, she seems like the winner, the one who got the life Rachel lost.
The smug victor, as Rachel sees her. But Anna's chapters reveal she's actually riddled with insecurity and fear. At first, it's all directed at Rachel, this unstable ex who keeps calling, showing up.
But slowly that fear starts to shift, doesn't it? She starts feeling this creeping unease about Tom himself.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us right to the center of the web, Tom Watson, Rachel's ex, Anna's husband. Presented initially as charming, patient, long-suffering even, dealing with Rachel's issues.
But that's the mask. He's revealed as the antagonist, a master manipulator, a pathological liar.
And his core motivation, it seems, isn't really about money or status in the usual thriller sense. It's about control. Absolute control over the women in his life, over their stories, over how they're perceived. He's the architect of so much of their pain.
Which leads us directly into, I think, the most powerful theme in the book, gaslighting.
Yeah.
Psychological abuse.
Yes. It's a stark portrayal. We need to talk about how Tom didn't just lie to Rachel. He systematically rewrote her reality for her.
He convinced her and everyone else that when she drank, she became violent, destructive, completely out of control. He fabricated incidents, twisted her memories of blackouts.
So she genuinely came to believe she was this monster he described. She couldn't trust her own mind, her own recollections, because he'd poisoned the well so thoroughly. It made her doubt everything, including what she might have seen the night Megan vanish.
And that's the chilling part of this kind of abuse in domestic thrillers, isn't it? It's so insidious. He created this narrative where she was the problem, which conveniently covered up his own secrets.
Absolutely. His affairs, his controlling nature, all hidden behind the smokescreen of Rachel's supposed instability.
So Rachel starts trying to piece things together. She contacts Scott, Megan's husband, thinking maybe he was involved. She contacts Megan's therapist, Dr. Abdick, because some fragmented memory points his way.
And all the while, Tom is right there whispering in her ear, reinforcing the idea that she's unstable, that she's imagining things, that she's dangerous when she drinks.
But then comes the breakthrough. The moment the manipulation starts to unravel. And it's not directly about the murder, is it?
No, it's something seemingly unrelated. Rachel finds out from the wife of Tom's old boss that Tom wasn't fired recently, like he claimed. He was actually fired years ago for having an affair at work.
And that lie, that one concrete, provable lie about his job. It's like a key. It unlocks everything for Rachel.
Exactly. She realizes if he lied so comprehensively about that, what else did he lie about? He didn't just lie about his job. He lied about her. About who she was. The monster wasn't real. It was his creation.
And with that realization, that clarity, the memory comes back. The real memory from the underpass.
Yes. She finally remembers clearly. It wasn't Scott or Dr. Abdick she saw arguing with Megan. It was Tom.
Megan was confronting him. She was pregnant with his child and was threatening to tell Anna to expose everything.
And when Rachel stumbled upon them, tried to intervene in her drunken state, Tom lashed out. He hit Rachel, knocking her out cold. That's how she got the head wound. And then, moments later, he killed Megan to silence her permanently.
It's devastating. Uh-huh. This leads to the climax. Rachel, finally knowing the truth, rushes to the house.
But Anna's already confronting Tom, too. She's found his secret burner phone, the one he used for his affairs. The evidence is undeniable now for both women.
Tom drops the act. He confesses, maybe boasts is a better word, and immediately turns his rage on Rachel.
But this is where the dynamic shifts completely. Anna sees him for what he is and intervenes. She realizes they're both his victims.
And Rachel, in a moment of pure survival, of reclaiming her agency, grabs a corkscrew, this symbol of domesticity, maybe even past happiness with Tom, and defends herself.
It's intense, and it requires that solidarity between the two women who are adversaries just moments before to survive him.
The resolution feels earned, though, doesn't it? Anna backs up Rachel's story of self-defense. Rachel is finally sober, finally free from Tom's control. Her journey from that passive girl on the train is complete.
Right. The train was her limbo, her passive observation post. She had to metaphorically get off the train and literally go into that dark underpass, confront the hidden truth to get her life back.
Looking back, the impact of this novel, its legacy, It goes beyond just a clever plot, I think. It really drilled down into the unreliability of memory, especially when it's tangled up with trauma.
Definitely. And how Hawkins connects very specific female experiences, infertility, infidelity, loss, abuse, to identity, to self-worth, sometimes to self-destruction.
And also, that theme of female solidarity emerging from shared victimhood. Rachel, Megan, Anna, they start as archetypes, almost pitted against each other. The crazy ex, the perfect victim who wasn't perfect, the smug new wife.
But they end up united, however briefly and tragically, by the realization that they were all manipulated and harmed by the same man. It's a powerful, if bleak, form of connection.
The feeling the book leaves you with is that claustrophobic suspense, certainly, but also maybe a deeper questioning of appearances. How well do we really know anyone?
There's that quote from Megan's perspective, reflecting on her past trauma. The holes in your life are permanent. You have to grow around them like tree roots around concrete. You mold yourself through the gaps. It speaks volumes about coping with damage.
I think The Girl on the Train stays with us because it grounds its thriller elements, not in some far-off conspiracy, but right there in the everyday, the commute, the suburban house, the relationships we think are safe.
Yeah, it forces you to consider that the most terrifying things can happen very close to home, behind perfectly normal-looking doors. Makes you look twice.
A chilling reminder. Expertly crafted. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.